We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus. Good morning, I'm Bill Hammack. Today I'm looking at the human-made objects which are the furthest away from the Earth, the twin Voyager space probes launched by the U.S. in the 1970s. Our guest today wrote the book Voyager, Seeking Newer Worlds in the Third Great Age of Discovery. It not only tells the fascinating story of these unmanned probes, but also places them in the context of the history of human exploration. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And if you like, send a question to me via email at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So let's welcome to Focus Stephen Pine. Stephen?
Yeah.
Good morning. I want to start by just talking about the physical details of Voyager 1 and 2. They haven't been on Earth since 1977, so a lot of people no doubt forgot what they look like. So describe these probes and to tell me a little bit about what they can do.
The original design for Voyager was to create a new spacecraft, a far-traveling spacecraft, start from scratch, build an ideal model. That was much too expensive. So the default setting was to take the old Mariner spacecraft, take that basic design, the bus, as it were, and then modify it. And some of the things that got changed, one of the most distinctive features of the Mariner was its solar panels. But the Voyager spacecraft are going to the edge of the solar system. They're way beyond the ability of the sun to provide enough energy for these things. So there are no panels. Instead, there was a special power device, RTG device, that would use radioactive decay. And so that is a special arm that comes off it. There's a large magnetometer boom that unfolded and came off. And then there's a large complex arm boom that came out that had most of the other instrumentation. And, of course, the cameras. Voyager, for the public, is best known by these startling images. Mm-hmm. So the other feature that is really dominant, that almost defines the spacecraft, is a 12-foot parabolic antenna. And that's sort of what you see. You see this huge white eye, almost, this cavity, and then all these sort of gangly booms coming off it.
So what kind of technology in these? I mean, are these vacuum tubes or solid state? I mean, I assume that they were designed in the late 60s, early 70s.
They were designed in the basically the early 70s, and the technology is pretty primitive by contemporary standards. One of the big shocks for me was that in doing the research, going to JPL, I went through the archives, which were pretty lean, by the way, but they have to be vetted for international trade in arms, mm-hmm. believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And it took up to 11 months to get some of this stuff through the system, just photocopies. And I was thinking how absurd this is. My digital watch has more high-tech than Voyager. These were really primitive. They were high-end stuff, but you know we're another 3-4 years, really, before the PC mm-hmm. comes on the scene. They're using magnetic tapes. This is really simple stuff by today's standards. But one thing that they had that was absolutely indispensable, perhaps the critical feature of all the stuff it carried, was that the computers, simple as they were, could be reprogrammed. And it could adapt. Mm-hmm. You could learn. You could work around problems as they came up. And so most of us think of Voyager, we think of the hardware, we think of that piece of machinery, and of course that's correct. But the real success of the mission was the software.
And some very simple computer by today's standards is your point, right? That they can reprogram from a distance and make it do probably elemental but important things. Is that correct?
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. And they could adjust. They could learn. So things broke down. Things were always breaking down. I mean, less perhaps than what we might expect, actually, given the complexity and the state of technology at the time. I mean, they had never, at the time this was conceived, engineers didn't believe, weren't sure they could get to Mars. Mm-hmm. Much less to something like Neptune.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tell you what. Why don't we take Voyager from when they're launched and look at that mission a little bit, and then we'll come back to some of the politics. So, first of all, there's two Voyager spacecraft. When were they launched? Were they launched together?
They were not. They were launched about 2 weeks apart. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Voyager 2 was the first launch, and that was August 20th, 1977. And then Voyager 1 was launched September 5th. Mm-hmm. And the reason being that they had slightly different trajectories. They were both going to Jupiter and then Saturn, but they had different missions, and they would arrive at different times. So they had different trajectories. And so they were named by their arrival date rather than their departure date. So there's a little anomaly on that, but it was a good decision. The public would never have straightened it out.
Does two mean it's arriving second? What do you mean by the arrival date?
That's right. So Voyager 2 was launched first, but it would be the second to arrive at Jupiter.
So let's talk a little bit about that journey. They're launched. There's two key kind of escape gravitational pulls that they have to go through. What are those two?
Well, the first is the gravitational pull of the Earth. They have to get into free orbit. And that is done with the rocket, the Titan Centaur rocket, and both are launched. But the critical thing, if you're going to go on, is to get to Jupiter and then use Jupiter for a gravity assist. Mm-hmm. And that, in a sense, gave it the momentum to move beyond, really, the attraction of the sun, mm-hmm. so that they could continue to zip along. And that was part of the discovery. That was part of the software discovery, if you will, that made it possible, because they didn't believe they could design these things long enough to survive a mission of 6, 8, 10, 12 years. And certainly we had no combustion booster that could get us going fast enough to make the trip within the lifespan of the hardware. Turns out the hardware is still going 33 years later.
So you made an important point there. I think that naively one assumes that there's rockets in these things and that's what's propelling them, but they really use a gravity technique that was discovered by a UCL student in 1961. Can you describe how the Voyager probes move from planet to planet? What is that technique?
Sure. Well, there were two critical insights that made what became known as the Grand Tour, that is the circuit of the outer planets possible. And one was the discovery of this gravitational assist, or it has a variety of terms. It's often called a kind of slingshot effect. And what happens is that as the spacecraft is drawn to the planet, it accelerates, and then as it's whipped around, it's given a huge boost in its velocity. And one would think that whatever it gained, it would then lose as it left from a giant planet like Jupiter. But it depends which way you're going around the sun. And if you're going in the right direction, then it actually gives a significant boost. It would basically double the velocity. So it really made long treks possible. The second insight was the discoveries. They're looking through possible trajectories, and Jupiter was sort of the key here. That was the pivot that would make it possible. That they realized that about every 176 years, the outer planets are aligned in such a way that a spacecraft, if it were propelled around Jupiter, could then go to Saturn, then go to Uranus, and then go to Neptune. And so it was possible that you could use this, each one of these giving it another boost. And that put it within the range of the plausible, sort of in some ways still fanciful, but plausible.
Stephen, if I've got that correct, that the initial mission was really to go just to Jupiter and maybe Saturn. But they discovered this kind of conga line configuration of planets that allowed them to barnstorm them all. Is that right?
The original mission, interestingly enough, was the Grand Tour. That they mm-hmm. realized that it was possible to go to the outer planets. It might be possible if designs were right. To go to the outer planets, and they wanted to do it all. And there were various configurations here. They would have a sort of five spacecraft going in different combinations over a series of years. But there was about a 3-year window, a launch window, where this was possible.
And so, what has happened though in terms of astronomy that allows this to happen? What event is that? Is there an alignment of the planets?
It's an alignment of the planets such that one could go sequentially, one after the other, so that one is not on the other side of its orbital plane.
And how often does such an alignment occur?
This occurs about every 175 or 176 years.
Okay, so the timing was crucial here in order to have what you're calling that grand tour. 10 years later, it could not have happened.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it couldn't happen later in your lifetime if you deferred it, or your children's lifetime, or probably even in your grandchildren's lifetime. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense that there was almost a kind of providential quality to this, that it's in the stars and the planets. How can you not do this?
Mm-hmm.
But it was too expensive. It was too complicated. Engineers had concerns. They'd still never get something that would survive that long. A lot of other scientists were interested other ways of doing science. This was too expensive. It was too complicated. And so the mission collapsed. It was canceled and then revived in a much stripped-down form that would simply go send a modified Mariner to Jupiter and Saturn. But it was built into that mission that if they succeeded in that task, one of the spacecraft would be targeted in such a way that it might be possible to go on to Uranus. And then embedded even more deeply was the possibility that they might go on to Neptune, but it was really doubtful that it would ever survive.
And by survive, do you just mean that the material would wear out, the metal, the craft?
They didn't know what the hazards of long-term, mm-hmm. long-distance traveling in space would be. They were afraid that components would just break.
Mm-hmm.
The electronics simply couldn't survive. They weren't sure what the radio. I mean, Pioneer 10 and 11 had been the first to go to Jupiter and basically got fried in the ionosphere of the planet. So they weren't sure what would happen, and they weren't sure how long the power pack could last. They weren't sure all the mechanical stuff could continue to work. They'd never built anything to last that long, mm-hmm. and they didn't know what it would be like.
Mm-hmm. And so if I'm understanding you correctly, it is the trajectory they start these on that keeps them going forever. It's not that these are firing rockets and redirecting themselves and so on. Do I have that correct?
Well, there's a general trajectory, yeah,
okay.
that would be very costly to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
If you decided that you wanted a major realignment, you would have to use up a lot of your, a lot of your thrust ability too.
Mm-hmm.
to do that rather than target a planet or whatever else. But there were lots of mid-course corrections.
So they can make small course corrections, and they use this device for the energy that you mentioned hanging out, the radiation, nuclear?
They had a thruster, and they have a three-axis set of thrusters that run off sort of hydrazine,
mm-hmm.
little hydrazine jets. That can orient it, and they could use this to position it as it, to have it focus on one feature or another, one moon or another, one aspect mm-hmm. of a planet mm-hmm. or another. And as they went further out, they're going very quickly, and it's taking a long time to send back. They're having to constantly adjust for the motion to be able to keep the image, to keep a steady image long enough to get something that isn't blurred. So it's mm-hmm. So you don't want to burn up all of your thruster stuff because your trajectory is long.
Mm-hmm.
Is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So they originally began, they had as many as 10,000 possible trajectories, and then they began very quickly working them down.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with author Stephen Pine. We're discussing the twin Voyager space probe launched by NASA in the 1970s. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area. Anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or use email WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So where are Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 right now as we speak?
They are a long way out. They each have passed the 12,000-day of continuous operation mark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They are in the heliosheath, actually. They've passed through that inner border where the solar winds go subsonic.
So I haven't heard the word shock. I haven't heard the word heliosheath. That's a
helio. It's the zone between the solar wind and the interstellar winds.
Okay.
It's large filmy boundary. In the inside, termination shock, and the outside, bow shock. They are in this sort of filmy ionic zone.
Hmm.
And really, you know, there are many ways to define the solar system. What is the limit of the solar system? But this is a pretty good operational one. They have both gone there. Voyager 1 completed its task at Saturn. It targeted Titan for maximum effect, and then that sent it north out of the plane of the ecliptic into the zone. And Voyager 2, after Neptune, targeted Triton and went south, so it's mm-hmm. later. They're both in there. They have been for several years. It's sort of a blustery border. We're not sure how deep it is, but they probably have another 10 or 12 years of power if everything is conserved and with a bit of luck. So the expectation is that they will pass through that and be able to send us a message to that effect. At that point, they will have, in a sense, passed through that veil of the solar system and be in true interstellar space.
And how many billions of miles are they away? I assume it's billions.
Well, it is billions. It depends how you measure it, whether you're measuring from the sun or the trajectory or whatever, but they're probably 12 to 15 billion miles out.
Wow. So we have a very appropriate question via email from a listener, Nick. He writes, is data still being collected and or sent from either of the Voyager spacecrafts, and if so, what is it?
Yeah, good question. The last sort of full body scan was by Voyager 2 of Neptune and its moons, and that was the last set of images and all the instruments that were still working doing it, and that was in 89. Voyager 1, after that, because it had left after its encounter with Saturn, was directed in 1990, Valentine's Day, actually, to mm-hmm. look back on the solar system and take a series of shots, a whole panorama that would sort of survey what the solar system looked like if you were approaching it from the outside. And this was a so-called family portrait, and they couldn't get all the planets. Some were a couple were too dark, Mercury's too close to the sun, but they got it. And this is also where this famous pale blue dot of Earth came from. That was the last set of images. And then to conserve fuel, all the instrumentation was shut down except the most basic on cosmic rays and really simple sensors. They are continuing to send back data. That's how we that information is how we it's known that they passed through termination shock, that they're mm-hmm. They're now into this zone, and it's how we will know that they leave. And I believe also last December, there was some strange information sent back, which was interpreted to mean that the entire solar system is passing through a kind of interstellar cloud, and that there was a shift recorded in Voyager's instruments on that. So it's really minimal life support. They've tried to shut down everything except the most basic, and to try to keep it. I mean, they're so far out
mm-hmm.
that how we can get information back is a problem.
Well, yeah, I have
so
to
you
say
have this whole deep space network, a very complicated system, to just receive the message. I mean, they're very strong.
Right. Stephen, this may be too technical of a question, but as an engineer, how in the world do you get a signal from these, even when they're in Jupiter and Saturn? Do we have special equipment here, that is searching just for those signals in some way? Is there some trick?
Yeah, well, they have their own antennas, and fortunately a backup antenna, because Voyager 2 lost its primary antenna before it even reached Jupiter. It was a administrative screw up, and the system, there was a breakage. So it did the whole thing on a backup antenna system, which has been unstable, and it keeps, and I'm not enough of an engineer, certainly not in electronics to be able to explain it in detail, but it sort of, the frequency moves around, and they have to keep searching for it. So part of the trick here was to develop a communication system, particularly a receiving system, that we could communicate with, and this was the so-called deep space network. And there are, three, one in Madrid, one in California, and one in Australia. And then for the outer encounters, they had to expand that to include some radio antennas. For the last encounter at Neptune, they were sort of combining with a very large array in New Mexico. I mean, there was a huge, huge expanse to be able to get the information quickly enough. What they're using now, they still use time on the Deep Space Network to send and receive messages, stay in contact, and they are getting some information. But it appears to be so feeble. How they can pick, frankly, I don't understand how they can pick it up out of the background noise.
I guess that's what I was getting at, yes. So, Stephen, we have taken Voyager now from its launch all the way out to 10 to 12 billion miles away from the Earth. So let's work a little bit to put it in context. And let's start with, what kind of things did we learn from the Voyager spacecraft?
Well, Voyager, I think Voyager had a couple of, had several purposes. One of the primary was, of course, science, but it was also an example of exploration, and maybe I can come back to that as well. But on the science mission, these were sort of planetary surveys, kind of body scans of the planets and their systems. Very little was really known, particularly the outer planets, at the time. The instruments Voyager had were mostly geophysical kinds of things, and they were upper atmosphere kinds of things. They were the stuff that the International Geophysical Year had focused on in looking at planet Earth. And that was the context for the first satellite launches, IGY. It was Sputnik and Explorer and so forth were intended as part of that program to get to the upper atmosphere, do those kinds of measurements. So the planetary program tended to keep that same set of instruments. Fortunately, they did add cameras as well. So what we got basically was a lot of information on cosmic radiation in interplanetary space and around the planets, a lot of information on magnetospheres. We got infrared. The stuff that most people focused on, of course, it's so mesmerizing, most people couldn't care less whether the magnetosphere of Uranus is tilted 90 degrees or not, or how this works out, were, of course, the TV images of not only the planets in some detail, but also the moons, which had never been seen. And it turns out that the moons, these are much more complicated systems than people anticipate. They're much more dynamic. And so the first big shock discovery from was Voyager 1 at Jupiter. It had made a great pass through, and then looking back, partly for navigational purposes, they looked at the moon Io, the innermost moon, saw an anomaly, and later realized they were witnessing a volcanic eruption. So they went back, and it turns out that Io is constantly erupting. It's just sort of a slow boil. It appears to be the tidal pole being so small next to this huge planet, and it warms it up. And that's also, all these eruptions and particles are why the ionosphere is so intense. Anyway, that was a real shock, that suddenly these moons are not just dead bodies, different sizes, but all the same. They were all different. They were almost all wholly different worlds, organized on different principles. And interestingly enough, the last of the moons to be inventoried, Triton, Neptune's largest moon, one of the coldest objects out there, turns out to have geysers. And so the mission is framed, in a sense, by image of eruptions, one of volcanoes on Io and then geysers on Triton. And that, in a sense, was the kind of discovery Voyager produced. There just wasn't a lot known about planets, and planets were really not where astronomy, where you made your reputation in astronomy.
Mm-hmm. So to place this in context a little bit, in the book, you do a great job of talking about Voyager in the context of exploration. In fact, you make the very interesting point that technology itself is vital, but not in itself drives discovery, that one needs, you know, insatiable curiosity, but also luck and politics play a part. And you note there are three times in Western history when the political, the military, economic, and scientific forces align to produce an age of exploration. The Voyager occurred during one of those times, but what were the other two times, and, you know, what characteristics do they have in common? So what was the first great age of discovery?
Well, is the traditional first great, what we commonly call the great age of discovery, or the voyages of the Renaissance. That is, during the 15th, 16th centuries, there was this sort of outrush of voyaging and exploring, led by Portugal, in Spain, and then others coming in various secondary roles. And this was primarily tied to the technology of ships, the discovery of the ocean. But it had an intellectual component, a cultural interest too, the Renaissance and the discovery that the ancients had not known all of the world.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are whole realms that were not in knowledge, and so there's a kind of sympathy, a parallel discovery with the development of modern science and these voyages. And these people are not scientists, as we understand it. They're looking for trade routes. They're looking for God, gold, and glory, were the traditional motives ascribed. And then it dies out by the early 18th century. In fact, exploration literary people are sort of mocking it. Think of Gulliver's Travels. The whole sense that this is something that the culture ought to do and it's interesting has faded. But then it revives again as the 18th century matures, and part of it is an alliance with science. So you take this old institution, geographic discovery, the voyage of discovery, and now you're giving it new purposes. And one of those purposes is science, or we might say the Enlightenment, the culture of the Enlightenment that science helped birth. But the other ingredient, and so it all starts over again. So you have a whole new wave of discoveries and rediscoveries. And then that finally fades out by the early 20th century because you've run out of places to get to. And you're about to go into world wars, depressions, and so forth.
So in that second age, though, you're saying that it linked with science. For example, Lewis and Clark, they had a true scientific mission to their work. They would be part of that second age, right?
They certainly would. I think the key figure is probably Alexander von Humboldt.
Okay.
Really the symbol of the age, the invention, really, of modern geography in the sense of which it is caught up with travel, discovery. Even when he's going to places that were already known, had in some ways been mapped, they had not been seen with the eyes of science.
Mm-hmm.
And Humboldt does that. So there is a real sense of dramatic rediscovery. And that's really what characterizes the Second Age, and a new set of motivations to go beyond simply finding trade routes and searching out all the possible places. Now, the other ingredient here, I mean, you have to have places to get to and
mm-hmm.
technological means to get there and understand it. But the other critical ingredient is some kind of rivalry. There has to be some kind of competition, as I see it, built in, or there's just not the incentive to invest on the scale that's required to do this. And in the first age, clearly the rivalry between Portugal and Spain
mm-hmm.
is projected out around the world, then others pile in. In the second age, certainly Britain and France begin the rivalry, but then it spills out as Russia, the United States, and other players come in. And for what I'm calling the Third Age, which really emerges after World War II, it's the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the international geophysical year, 1957-58, was sort of what I would call the announcement of the Third Age. This is where it sort of came together.
Let's talk about that geophysical year of 1957-58. That's a kind of an odd phrase. Was that an event? What happened? What does that mean?
Yeah. There had been a tradition of international polar years in which it was proposed that the great powers and those interested in science would pool their resources towards some common interest.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that had grown out of one of the defining events, inaugural events for the second great age of discovery, which was the survey of the transit of Venus in 1761 and 67, and had sent voyages out, scores, dozens, to all parts of the world to measure this event, an amazing, amazing shift. That idea was revived in 1882 for an international polar year. Then 50 years later, there was another attempt. And then instead of waiting 50 years, the technology had improved. The interest was such that it was proposed that the third polar year, focusing this time on Antarctica, would occur in 1957. And then because of they expected a lot of solar activity, they expanded it another 6 months. So it actually ran a year and a half, 57-58. And then as this idea caught on, it expanded from a polar year to a survey of the whole planet, and in some ways a survey of the planet and its moon. So the Earth, which in some ways was known, was now going to be re-examined, resurveyed, this time with new instruments and ideas, particularly remote sensing. Devices were starting to become important, but you could mount serious expeditions to the polar ice sheets. And it was within that context that satellites, that rockets were proposed to launch satellites or instrument packages to look at the upper atmosphere. And that was the context for Sputnik and U.S. Explorer satellites.
So I want to return for a minute to the Cold War, but let me announce that, that this is Focus, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Stephen Pine, author of Voyager, Seeking New Worlds in the Third Great Age of Discovery. The book tells the story of NASA's two unmanned space probes, and I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL, if you're in the area, or anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or use email, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So this International Geophysical Year starts mapping the planet, and it sets up a little bit of a rivalry that plays into the Cold War, does it not? And so how does the Cold War fit into this?
That's a great question. The Cold War was responsible for creating some of the technologies mm-hmm. that would really drive particularly space exploration, namely rockets, large rockets, satellite capability, remote sensing instruments, and others. And it also gave a sense in which just as Spain and Portugal had projected their rivalry out into the Indies and elsewhere, so the U.S. and Soviet Union would carry their rivalry in perhaps symbolic forms, but carry it out scientifically and with technological displays and prowess. But because Antarctica at the time, there really were no serious claims, territorial claims in Antarctica. There were some for the peninsula, but in general, the argument was that this ought to be a kind of demilitarized place, and let's play out the rivalry with a sort of technological posturing or other sort of scientific skills rather than making this an arena for actual fighting. And so Antarctica, during IGY, it was a tradition of open bases, open exchange of information. But it's very clear that behind it, why did the major powers get behind this and push it was because they didn't want the other to be able to use it as an arena for display and be left mm-hmm. out. But they were able to defuse it, and there's a kind of cold peace that settles on the Antarctic, and then that becomes the basis for an Antarctic treaty which also becomes the basis for treaties governing outer space.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, we have a call, so I'd like to take the caller from line one, Champaign County. Caller, please go ahead.
Right. What is the power pack? Is it a decaying radioactive thing? And is anybody, there's kind of some attraction to just having it go out into space, but is there any scientific reason to have it, like, orbit back around a planet lit, not necessarily Pluto, but some outer thing that you could coordinate it to slingshot it back? Now, I realize it would take a long time to get back, mm-hmm. but what about, you know, the cosmic ray effect on the semiconductors and that. I'm actually, if it is a radioactive power supply, I'm wondering whether there's any anything could be learned. I mean, all this could be simulated, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That part of it could be radio ionizing effect on semiconductors could be, but the actual real life cosmic ray effect on this device. Is there anybody mm-hmm. thinking that it might be nice to slingshot it back? Now, obviously, the timeline timeline on that is a long time.
Yeah.
But I'll hang up and listen.
Right, Stephen, our caller essentially has three questions, all of which are fascinating. First of all, describe that power pack a little more, which is what he asked for. You know, how does that work? What is that exactly?
Well, it's a radiothermal generator. It was actually developed by the Department of Energy or Atomic AEC, I believe, initially was interested, and it had some military funding. It uses a plutonium source, and then the decay of that provides enough energy to heat and drive some to power it. And the reason they had to use it was because they're too far out for solar energy, and that was the only thing possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really what is. That and the hydrazine that provides the thrusters are the two things that will determine the life of these spacecraft. So they're trying to, and this just decays. There's no way to stop it. So I think they've got 10 or 12 years maybe, and they're dead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. His second question was, is the radiation killing the semiconductors and the components in there, or how did they design it so that it didn't?
Oh, I see. So the radiation from the power pack.
Even just out in outer space or whatever, yeah.
Well, the power pack, I mean, it was shielded clearly because they've got a lot of instruments as well, and they don't want those disturbed. So it's on a boom, and it's extended away as far as they could from the instruments it shielded. What is causing the breakdown of the semiconductors and others? I really don't know. They did go through a special hardening, whatever that means. Because of fear from Jupiter in particular, and then they realize there may be other stuff out there. I don't know what's causing the breakdowns mm-hmm. On this, and it's pretty old technology anyway, and stuff is constantly breaking, but they're able to work around it. They've been able – I see they just did another software patch. Voyager 2 had communication problems, and they've reestablished it. Now it's transmitting its data again. I really don't know.
Okay, and his third question, which is fascinating to me, is why not slingshot the thing back toward us? Why did they choose not to do that, or could it not be done?
That is a great question. In fact, that's one of the things I end the book with, because I'm approaching this not as an engineer or a scientist or even a space guy. I'm approaching it as a historian, interested in the long history of exploration and how mm-hmm. this fits in. And thinking about what is Voyager now? Okay, it's still doing some science. We're still learning stuff. We will continue. There's nothing else. We have no alternative. I mean, it's going to be a long time before we have something else that could do this. But it's taken on, sounds a little mushy, but almost a vision quest quality. It's just almost mm-hmm. pure narrative. It's just there it is. They're going out and out. And I was thinking of the traditions, the mythologies, the stories of sort of the mm-hmm. heroes who go beyond to different worlds or beyond the veil, and then they come back and they bring what they've learned. And there's a long tradition of this kind of study. And I was thinking, you know, Voyager in many ways fits that. In fact, it fits it awfully closely. It's mm-hmm. astonishing how much the Voyager story can be mapped onto that old mythological structure, and it works from the initial call, which is refused and then accepted, and the tests and the trials, and you go through. And I was thinking, but the big problem with the Voyager mission fitting that is that they don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the anomalies with the sense of these robots as explorers, that it was always assumed explorers came back. Well, they didn't always, because they got killed, things happened. But it was assumed that they would, and they would bring back their knowledge with them.
Mm-hmm.
But these are not. And I thought, wouldn't it have been a great design if this mission, since you've got two of them, if the mission design had been conceived by someone versed in this kind of mythological sense, and you have one, it just goes on, and you have the other come back. And maybe it takes 1,000 years.
Hmm.
Maybe it takes 5,000 years.
Sure.
But what a great story. What a great narrative closure.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what Voyager does is it takes its home with it. And it has this gold-plated record filled with sights, sounds, greetings, languages, in a sense a sort of album of Earth, which is, each of them has it. It's done as a phonograph record. And so if they're ever discovered or whatever, then you could play this and learn about where it came from. And, I mean, talk about ancient technology. This was high-tech in 1977, a photograph record. They even have a little stylus to play it. But, you know, if you showed this to most Earthlings now, they'd have no idea how to play it.
Well, we did get an email question, very appropriate. How would one read the media on the golden records on the two Voyager spacecrafts? And so they actually have a needle with it? Is that what you're
telling
me?
Yeah, they actually have a needle and some sort of instructions, which... presumably, some alien intelligence, if stumbled upon these things, could learn how to play the play this and read it. I mean, it's all kind of nutty, frankly. I mean, it's interesting.
So, Stephen,
but it was very clear that the message was not for someone out there. It was a message to Earthlings.
Sure.
We're trying to decide who we are. We're telling ourselves this is the best of who we are, and we're creating, in a sense, a time capsule. It may go to a place beyond time, but it's a kind of time capsule, a statement of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
How we think of ourselves in the best terms.
Just,
so it carries that.
Mm-hmm.
But one footnote on this, the first of the Star Trek movies imagines a Voyager, a later Voyager, I think a Voyager 6.
A V'ger, is it not?
V'ger, because it's somehow picked up a spot of tar or oil in space, and it has come back, and now it has returned. And it is trying to bring back everything it's learned with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's stuff. So there's a sense in which, in a literary or philosophical or even sort of mythological template base, that it needs to come back.
So, Stephen, we have some email questions and a phone call I want to get to. So from Icarus 2 via email, he writes, does your guest know anything about Voyager speeding up inexplicably? I could swear I heard something about there being something strange about its speed. Does that ring a bell with you?
I have heard a little bit about that. There was something on the Pioneer spacecraft, and there were some anomalous accelerations, as I recall, and they were not really explained. I don't think that has been true for Voyager, but I really couldn't say. It has certainly not been a major issue, but there may be some anomalies that just the gravity as we understand it now doesn't seem to account for.
All right, let's turn to our caller on line 4 from Bloomington, Illinois. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi. You talk about the three ages of discovery being made possible by a convergence of various systems, including the political. And I wonder, as a historian, if you could address the impact of the current political climate, including what seems to be a large segment of the population being anti-intellectual or anti-education, and the effect that that's going to have on future discoveries or space exploration?
Well, interesting question.
Yeah, that is a good question, and I'm not quite sure there's a simple answer to that. It's not just the current political climate or Americans' particular enthusiasm. What happened historically was that one of the reasons exploration in Europe kept going is that if one faltered, somebody else stepped in, because it was not a case of Europe And this is sort of the contrast with Ming China, which mounted these extraordinary expeditions in the 15th century, huge things, we've never been matched, and then just collapse. The great voyages of Zheng Ho just disappear because the government changes. That didn't happen in Europe because if Portugal falters, Spain steps in. If Spain loses its grip, the Dutch move in, or the British, somebody else keeps going. So part of the question is, if this is really a large-scale thing, even if the United States pauses or starts just sinking, is someone else going to step in and keep it up? And I don't know that there's an answer to that, but I do think there has to be some kind of rivalry, and there has to be some sort of cultural engagement. And so I think it's not just the science that's going to matter and whether these apparently abstruse things continue. There's a narrative quality. There's a story quality to it. And part of the magic of Voyager is that it has a kind of mythic feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not trying to go too far out on you here to lose it, but there's some stories just sink, and this one does.
Well, let's trace that mythic thread, because an interesting aspect of your book is how literary form shaped our notions of space exploration and how they influenced Voyager. For example, how did Arthur C. Clarke conceptualize space exploration, you know, for the Western mind?
Well, there's a long tradition. I mean, because exploration got embedded in Western civilization as a kind of institution, and it acquired a kind of art form, and then it bonds with science, it acquires a kind of cultural density that really gives it a sense of stamina, and people expect it. How can we be who we are without exploring? And people like Clarke would argue, and Sagan following him, that, you know, we have to do this or we lose our zest. We simply lose the energy that sustains our civilization. We just become worn out and we quit trying. And we have to do this. They are also deeply committed, a large fraction, deeply committed to colonization, to projecting a particular kinds of stories of Western experience, particularly in settler societies like the United States, where we have to continue this. We need a new geographic frontier, and we have to do this, or the whole enterprise just implodes. It just sinks. And those are great stories, and they're often powerful motivations. I'm personally much more interested in the robots. I think taking Manifest Destiny to Mars is nuts. I don't think in any near term we should be trying to colonize in any serious way. And what does it mean? These are places where nobody has ever lived. Nobody can live without all this prosthetic, shields and rest. We've been in Antarctica. At least you can breathe the air in Antarctica. We've been in Antarctica with bases for 100 years. What does that look like? That would be much closer to my sense of what this might happen.
Stephen,
so I think that certainly those kinds of stories and romances have been powerful motivators in the past.
So, Stephen, we have another call that I'd like to fit in. So, caller on line 2 from Danville, Illinois. Please go ahead.
A little bit earlier in the show, you had said something about, you know, this explorer has not come back. And I'd like to propose that it has. All the previous explorers went out to find information, really, is what it was all about, whether it was just the new land or whether it was scientific exploration. They came back with that information, and that was their success, and that was their notoriety. Voyager has done the same thing. It has come back. It's been with us all. It never left.
So, caller, we have about a minute left, and so I'd like to get Stephen to respond to that in the last minute. But thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, there's always been a sense of sending back messages, sending back packets of information and so forth, but there was always the physical presence coming back, the return, the embodied return, if you will, has always been a part of that story. I think in the contemporary age of exploration, that's not going to be the case. And I think that sort of modernist philosophy makes that reasonable. I mean, I think we have ways to deal with that.
Well, Stephen, we're at the end of our time, so thanks for taking the time to chat.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been very
good
enjoyable. I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Stephen Pine. Voyager, Seeking New Worlds in the Third Great Age of Discovery, is his fascinating book about the unmanned space probes of the 1970s. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.